Before I get started, I just want to thank the team of women that have been working on this. And we're all getting pampered here tonight, but I've had the benefit of being pampered by them for 3 months with cards and texts and emails and just beautiful support. So I just thank you all so much. In my mind, this all began after my first ever all-woman road trip last fall, which I highly recommend if you've never done that. It was so much fun. We were at a retreat in Colorado, and after we returned, I realized that I hadn't served on a ministry team in a year or so, and I missed it a lot. So I left word for Tammy, the advisor for this amazing group of ladies, and asked if there were any openings on the team. And I got this kind of cryptic voicemail back that said, "So glad that's where your heart is. We'll talk soon." She came over a couple of weeks later carrying a warm plate of blueberry muffins. And well, let's just say that the ministry position she had in mind for me wasn't at all what I was expecting. I've spent a number of years, as Nancy and Yvette have both said, a number of years in women's ministry and had the pleasure of asking women to consider speaking at events just like this one. And I loved praying for them as they prepared, and I would wait expectantly for what I knew God would share through them. But I must admit, when Tammy asked me, my first thought was, will God really show up for me? As I look out at your beautiful faces, and it is fun to do that, I know that many of you have been through devastating loss and disappointment. And I'm reminded of a quote by Regina Brett: "If we all threw our problems in a pile and could choose from everyone else's, we'd grab our own back." I wonder, how then could I share my story? But it is our story, mine and God's, and it's what He's used to draw me into a deeper relationship with Him. So I share with the hope that part of my journey might resonate in some way that helps you with yours. My walk with the Lord began in 1988. I was 26 years old. I was raised in a home that loved God, but from as far back as I can remember, God was my judge, and when I died, He would decide if my good deeds outweighed my bad. If the scale tipped toward good deeds, heaven; bad deeds, eternity without God, what we call hell. It was as simple and horribly complicated as that for me. Can you imagine what it was like for me to learn that Jesus was the answer? That He didn't just tip my performance scale, He completely destroyed it. Through belief in Him, that His death on the cross covered my sins, I was assured of eternal life. I remember one day walking through the grocery store, looking people right in the face and thinking, "Don't you know why I am so happy?" I'm sure they probably thought I was nuts, but I do remember that grin. During this time, I was living in Phoenix, Arizona, and Dennis and I had been married nearly 3 years. When we met in the mid-80s, he had just begun working on a resort development in his home state of Idaho. Shortly after we were married, we began our own architectural business with the goal to build the business, of course, but our primary focus would be to work through and fund the efforts necessary to bring the Idaho Resort Project to reality, which we called Valbois, the resort on Cascade Lake, Idaho. The effort was huge. There was no separating our professional life from our personal where Valbois was concerned. Our self-identity and focus became, for us, irrevocably linked with the realization of the project. After a time, it reached the point that we could not continue to finance the effort on our own. And 1989 found us with a French business partner, quickly followed by a second, and a long-awaited move to Idaho to work on the resort full-time as the partnership's local presence. Within about 6 months of coming to Christ, this new Christian would move to a new town where she knew no one. Now, mind you, I was still perpetually smiling about my salvation, but knew nothing about a walk with Jesus in my daily life. I remember the feeling of wanting more, but wasn't sure exactly what that could be. There was no longer a question of where I would spend eternity, so what more could there be? Sadly, my spiritual life would remain at this point for the better part of a decade. So, in August of 1989, we moved to Idaho, almost 20 years to the day that Dennis moved away after graduating from, wait for it, the University of Idaho. We looked for a home before moving, but with the limited income we'd received from the partnership, we decided to live in Dennis's grandparents' home in Meridian for about 6 months until things settled in with the project. We were finally able to work on the resort full time. And the work days were long, but we were tackling them together, and it was a very exciting time for us. For me, it was a new city. Boise had recently finished their downtown renovation, and I loved working right in the middle of it. Also new was a four-season climate, specifically winter. A favorite memory I have is when Dennis suggested I get boots to wear when walking around downtown in the cold. Remember, this was the late 80s. Pumps and pantyhose were the fashion order of the day, and there was no way I was going to wear boots with a dress. The last time I had seen that was go-go dancers on TV. Well, when I walked outside in my stylish pumps the first day there was snow on the ground, my feet flew right out from underneath me, and the only thing that kept me from falling flat on my back was that my arm was linked through Dennis's. And needless to say, I now understood the need for boots, and we stopped on the way home to buy a pair. Within a year after moving, we became pregnant with our first, and as it turns out, only child. In May of 1991, Devon was born, and to say he was a blessing is putting it mildly. In the midst of a life that was beginning to get difficult professionally, he turned us into a family and allowed our identity to open up and become so much more than it otherwise would have been. God knew how much we would need Devon, and as always, his timing is perfect, whether we realize it or not. The story is much too long to go into tonight, but a few short years after arriving in Boise, our efforts with Valbois began to unravel. We found ourselves abandoned by the partners and the management team they had put in place. Dennis would continue for several years to work on the project full-time in an effort to salvage it, and I would continue to work part-time alongside him for a while. The management team had allowed over $3 million of unpaid bills to accrue, much of it owed to local companies. We felt a profound sense of responsibility. Although control had been taken from us, Dennis had conceived the project, and we had brought it to Idaho. And personally, at this point, more than a decade of professional years had been spent working hard to bring the project to reality. What did our future hold without Valbois? Life in every sense of the word was hard. It had been hard for a very long time. And to say we were struggling financially would be an understatement. It's funny the things that come back to you. I remember taking a Ziploc baggie from the box one day and seeing there were just a few more left. And I was able to make the connection between buying a new box of Ziploc baggies and buying food. And that began a practice I have to this day of washing them until they fall apart. My prayers were continual that God would allow our effort to bring the project to reality, for our work over the past decade to not be in vain. We often used to say that if we were to write a book, it would be hard to decide whether to write it as fiction or nonfiction. The story told in its true form was full of success and failure, intrigue and betrayal. But ultimately, someone was found to buy the project, meeting our condition that all outstanding debts would be paid. Their exception was paying anything owed to the partners, which included us. I'll always be grateful that others were financially restored, but after nearly 15 years of pouring heart and soul into the effort, our role in Valbois was very suddenly over. Mourning the loss of this very public dream was difficult and nearly impossible to share with others. In fact, many, probably the first time I've voiced these words to just about anybody. There was the reality and embarrassment of having failed professionally, the impact we suffered financially that would be felt for years to come, and there's the emotional toll it had all taken and would continue to take. It would be a couple of years before I heard anything publicly about work on the project, what would eventually be known as Tamarack Resort. We were watching the news one evening, and they began telling about the groundbreaking that would soon begin at Tamarack. I remember feeling like someone had dropped the floor right out from underneath me. I looked at Dennis, and I said, "I never thought this would happen." And he was like, "Really? This must be hard for you." I realized then that while he always knew this day would come, I, on the other hand, never expected it to. Sometime later, we would be at our family cabin, located directly across the lake from the resort. We went for a walk, and Dennis took me over to the shoreline to point out the work that was beginning on the structures and on the ski hill. I remember thinking so strongly that I was sure I had voiced the words, "God, if it were going to happen anyway, why couldn't it have been us?" You see, I had prayed for the project to come to reality. When it didn't, through our efforts, I assumed it wasn't in God's will, period. It never occurred to me that it just wasn't in His will that we would be a part of it. My faith in God's plans were very limited to what I could envision the outcome to be, and to watch our dreams unfold at the hand of another would hurt for a very long time. A couple of years before we would know Valbois' final outcome, you'll remember that I mentioned we were struggling financially in a very big way. Dennis came home one day for lunch, and as we were talking, I could see that it was really weighing on him. After he left, I got out the yellow pages, remember those, and called a temporary help agency. We were hopeful that Dennis's efforts at finding financing for Valbois would soon be successful. So in the meantime, I decided I could do a little temporary work to help out. I had an appointment the next day with an agency, and they suggested a 3-month temp job with a local engineering firm. They were going through a conversion of their financial system and needed someone to cover various positions while the staff went to training. I would need to commit to 3 months. This was longer than I had in mind since, well, things would surely happen with Valbois soon, and our financial problems would then be resolved. Even so, after talking about it, we decided that it would be a good idea. Devin was nearly 4 years old, and I was apprehensive about leaving him full-time for that long, but it felt good to be doing something that would help in a concrete way. As I look back, I'm pretty sure I envisioned myself wearing a sash that said Wife of the Year when our current financial problems were resolved. In January of 1995, I walked through the doors at CH2M Hill for the first time. I still remember leaving that morning. We had found a wonderful daycare where Devin stayed part-time while I worked on the resort, but I'd never left him under these circumstances. I'd be working for another company where I didn't have the same working mom flexibility that self-employment offered. And I'd be leaving him for Dennis to get ready and take to daycare. So that first morning, I laid out all of his clothes and I made sure that Dennis knew the direction to comb his hair so that that swirly spot in the back of his head didn't stick straight up. It covered the very important things. Even though we had agreed it was best, I would be even further removed from Dennis and his work efforts during the day. We had spent the last 10-plus years focused on a similar goal professionally, and the last 6 years working together exclusively toward that goal. But it was just for 3 months. I could do this. The first few months were even harder than I realized they would be. Things were gearing up for the changes that were coming in the department, and working full-time was much more exhausting than the part-time work I had been doing within our own company since Devin was born. And then the group lead gave notice, and I was offered the position. Truthfully, 3 months was still longer than I had in mind, but nothing had changed for us financially. In fact, although Dennis continued to pursue salvaging the project, there was nothing on the horizon at this point. Things were actually getting worse for us instead of better. We discussed the offer and decided I should take it. And within several months of beginning with CH, the switch was flipped to the new financial system. And to say the decision to go live was premature is a gross understatement. Nothing, and I mean nothing, worked. Resources were low, expectation was high, and the hours we worked were very, very long. With a need at home for as much help as I could financially give, and the need at the office for as many hours as I could work, the answer seemed obvious and exhausting. I started work very early with the hope of being able to leave at a reasonable enough time to pick up Devin. I had this kind of measure for myself, for us. I didn't want him at daycare later than 4 o'clock, if at all possible. So I would pick him up. If I couldn't pick him up, Dennis would, which often became the case. I would leave home before 6 a.m., the mornings were dark, and so was my spirit. Each day, as I drove into work, I would pray, "Please, God, let this be the day that I can give notice." This prayer became my mantra. The hard work and pleas to God continued for several years. For some reason, the mornings were toughest. I left for work so early that I was the only person awake at the house. By the time I was driving to work, I had sunk into a very dark place of hopelessness where I would often cry out to God to please just get me out of this. Strangely enough, once I got to work, I was able to work hard and do my job well. I don't think anyone suspected the basket case I often was just before arriving. Even though I was not trusting him in the situation, God allowed me this, and I was grateful. At about this time, the Valbois chapter of our life was over, and my hope had rested on its success. Dennis shifted his professional efforts to working as a sole proprietor, pursuing work as an architect to help meet our financial needs, but also continuing to pursue larger professional efforts. And I transferred my hope from Valbois' success and placed them squarely on my husband's shoulders, praying that something in his efforts would come to fruition. I should probably mention here that there was no reason for me to not like my job. The company itself was very employee-friendly. One of the most important benefits the job allowed me was flexibility with the time that I started my day. This was very important to me, as once Devin was in school, it allowed me most of the time to be able to pick him up rather than send him to after-school care. Dennis was in charge of mornings, and I, most of the time, was able to pick him up after school. And my supervisor could not have treated me better. The company and people were great. This was just not the plan. It was not what I wanted, and it was not what I signed up for. I began praying that God would help me to like my job. It seemed pretty reasonable, right? He had me there. Surely He wanted me to be happy with it. I just needed to truly want it. 5 years after starting my 3-month temp job, I moved into a different department within the company. The workload and pressure was less intense, and for a time, things were better. But you probably are not going to be terribly surprised to learn that that didn't last. So I prayed harder to like my job. But rather than an accepting heart, my emotional feelings toward it began to affect me physically. There were times, I remember, when I would sit down at my desk to work and begin to feel my chest compress and my breath would come in short gasps. Mind you, there was not a terrible boss bearing down on me, and I could not have worked with nicer people. But there I was, sitting at my desk, having panic attacks. I remember when I was growing up, my mom would sometimes cook with a pressure cooker. I know they're making a comeback, but this was the old-fashioned kind with the lid that had the metal disc on top. Yeah. As the pressure inside grew, the tick, tick, tick of the metal disc grew faster and faster until at just the right time, she would release the steam and remove the lid. This is the perfect analogy for my emotional condition. The pressure would slowly build, and there was nothing I could do about it. Tick, tick, tick. Until at some point, I would release a stream of tears. The pressure would release. I would feel better for a time, and then the cycle would begin slowly again. Because this was not where I wanted to be, and it was not what I signed up for. Since I was obviously having no success in my prayers to like my job and doors weren't opening for me to be able to quit, at some point I decided God must want me to do something else. He must have something else in mind for me out there. So I began looking at jobs, and I applied for one that and got called for an interview for an office manager HR position, which I thought fit my experience and my interest and desire to work with people more. And I, like I said, I was called in for an interview, and during the interview, the woman conducting it said she knew one of my personal references. Their sons had gone to high school together. Well, the interview could not have gone better. We discussed the two things that I couldn't be flexible with, my work schedule and compensation. And she didn't feel there would be a problem. And I skipped out of there feeling like I would be packing my desk very soon. That afternoon, I received a message and called her back after work. She began with, "I so enjoyed our meeting this morning, but..." Instantly, I thought, "But? There is no but in this conversation." She continued, "But I spoke with the partners, and they don't want the person in the position to leave earlier than 5 o'clock. My heart sank. By this point, Devin was going into junior high, and I didn't feel it was at all what I should do, leave a job with the flexibility that was so important to me, to us as a family, and accept one that wouldn't allow it. While I knew it was the right thing to do, to not take the position, I sank into a deep pit of despair for several days after that, because I think I heard that door close. I knew I was where I should be. And sometimes that's just hard to accept. In the midst of it all, I felt abandoned by God, plain and simple. Yes, He had saved me for eternity in the next life, but where was He in this one? And I wondered, what decision could I have made differently that might have changed things? Why was I denied options and choices that others seemed to so freely have? When I began praying about this evening, God very quickly laid on my heart what I was to share, like it or not. And also a passage in Jeremiah 29 that resonated with me. In this passage, Jeremiah is delivering a message to Israel. They, God's chosen people, have been taken away from Jerusalem into exile in Babylon. In terms all of us here, I think, can understand, God the Father was delivering some much-needed, very tough love to his child Israel. God makes it clear that this is not a matter of the Babylonians overpowering them, but that he, the Lord their God, had allowed it to happen. His exact words are, "This is what the Lord Almighty, the God of Israel, says to those I carried into exile from Jerusalem to Babylon." While I realize that the likelihood of those of us born and raised in the West have ever experienced the exile that Israel is undergoing, I do believe we have all been literally or figuratively in a place where we don't want to be. Life on earth is just plain hard sometimes, and all we want to do is find a solution or wait it out. However, in his message to Israel, God makes it clear that their time of exile won't be over quickly, but rather than withdraw and simply mark time, he calls them to thrive during their time of exile. Specifically, he says to build houses and settle down, plant gardens and eat what they produce, marry and have sons and daughters. Find wives for your sons and give your daughters in marriage, so they too may have sons and daughters. Increase in number there, do not decrease. He also continues with a command that was, to this point in time, unheard of. God tells them to also seek the peace and prosperity of the city to which I have carried you into exile. Pray to the Lord for it. Pray for your enemy, he's telling them. Because if it prospers, you too will prosper. In the same way, in the midst of my exile, the place where I didn't want to be, God began to help me see that although my work situation remained unchanged, I could still pursue those things that he was laying on my heart. I may not yet be able to be a stay-at-home mom, that go-to person the teacher calls for every classroom event, but I could arrange my work schedule so that I could volunteer in the classroom once a month and go on field trips a couple of times a school year. I remember when Devin was in fourth grade, he took a Spanish class after school once a week. I left work on time and spent that 45 minutes in his classroom helping his teacher while he was in another one learning Spanish. It sounds like such a small thing, but I looked so forward to that time each week. God was also laying on my heart a desire to serve in some way here at Cole. One of my "please let me quit my job" prayers was centered on allowing it to happen so that I could follow this longing. I vividly remember finally saying to him that if he was giving me this desire to serve under my current circumstances, then would he please give me the time and the energy to do it. Shortly after this, I saw a notice in the bulletin that they could use some help at the Sunday School Appreciation Dinner. It was only one evening, so I volunteered and began doing so each year for several years. In a similar way, I would become involved in women's ministry. Initially volunteering the evening of an event exactly like this one, which led eventually to becoming a member of the ministry team. Now, people tend to think that these committees are all about the program, the end result. But they are so much more than that. As part of the team, I would work with other women who love the Lord. Our meetings would first focus on him through a time of devotion and prayer for each other and our speaker. Only after our focus was drawn where it should be did we begin to talk the details of the program. Mind you, for someone working in the secular workplace and very task-oriented, this didn't initially make sense. I mean, let's get in get down to business, and get the job done. But I would begin learning through other women and the planning of an event what it meant to be open to the Lord and to trust Him. While this led to so much growth for me, one of the most important things I did was to begin attending evening Bible studies. I learned so much through my own personal time and then sharing each week with our group. I would begin to learn what the more was that I had been seeking. More than a decade after coming to Christ, I would finally begin to learn what it meant to walk with Him. And God would begin to show me how I could thrive during my time of exile, just as He called Israel to do. A byproduct of my time spent in women's ministry and Bible studies was a newfound love for spending time with other women. I mean, I think we are pretty awesome. I would be shepherded by ministry team leaders and our pastors, Nancy and Laura. Then I would begin learning how to shepherd other women as I was called to lead on the ministry teams. I loved it. Don't get me wrong. Anyone who has ever served with a team of any kind knows it's not all roses. And ministry has its moments as well. But I would watch God show up in amazing ways as He called us to work together. I began to pray that God would allow me to enter into ministry in some way. Yes, this would be a new, "God, please let me quit my job so I can" prayer. But serving Him, ministering alongside other women, why would He place that longing on my heart and not allow me to fulfill it? While God was teaching me how to thrive outside of work as a wife and mom and in ministry and Bible study, I continued to struggle in my work situations and with feelings of being left to just manage this life on my own. I wondered why I couldn't take the faith I was learning about in my personal life and apply it to my professional. Then, just over 10 years after beginning my 3-month temp job, I would have the opportunity to move back into accounting, the department where I spent my first 5 years with the company. My role there would be different, though, but it would draw heavily on my previous time there. I would be teamed with a coworker, also new to the department, and our job would be to create tools, for lack of a better word, that would help the accountants do the mechanical aspects of their job in less time. I quickly discovered that my favorite part of the job was not necessarily the time spent creating the tool. It could often be my least favorite. But it was meeting with my coworkers to discuss what was needed and planning through what the end result would need to be to meet their needs, and then ultimately training them on its use. Over time, I came to realize that if I did my job well, it could make certain aspects of theirs easier. You see, I had been gone from the department for 5 years, and while many faces had changed, some things had not. Workload was still intense, with changes to policies and procedures continuing at lightning speed sometimes. I wish I could tell you that the light clicked on, and I quickly began to see God's hand in all of this. But you've probably learned by now that I'm a very slow learner. But that's okay, because God has infinite patience. I can't tell you how it happened, because it was very slowly. But over the years, I began to realize that God was fulfilling my desire to minister to and alongside other women. It wasn't at all like I expected, so I struggled to recognize it. But slowly, God began to show me that the work I was doing could make a difference in the lives of those I worked with, the vast majority of whom are women. I may be an empty nester with a nearly 25-year-old son, but I remember the days like they were yesterday, when I would get up to go to work as early as possible, then dash off at the end of what was often a very long day to try and not be the last mom to pick Devin up from school. Then, and only then would my most important job begin, that of mother to Devon and wife to Dennis. So, if what I have learned technically over the years helps make some part of my coworker's job easier, so that at the end of her day, her most important job can begin, whatever it might be, then I want to be able to say, I am where I want to be, and I know where God is in all of it. A couple of years ago, Devon gave me an autographed book for Mother's Day called On Killing by Lieutenant Colonel Dave Grossman. I know, right? Quite the Mother's Day gift. But just as we see fathers dressed in pink and having tea parties with their daughters, we mothers of sons must do the same. Meet them right where their interests lie. For example, for me, the big question where Star Wars was concerned was what it must have felt like for Luke Skywalker to discover that Darth Vader was his father. Instead, Devon and I would actively discuss what it must feel like when the Millennium Falcon shoots into hyperdrive. And still to this day, the big question for us is why, when they need that hyperdrive the most, does it always break down? The same was true when he was in college. We talked about the things he was interested in and drawn to, issues such as violent crime, and this book was one we discussed while he was researching for a report. It is, just as the title suggests, a book about the emotional effects of killing in war and in society. As strange as it may sound, something the author writes about hit home very profoundly for me and began to peel back some layers of understanding. He shares that when we become intensely angry or frightened, we stop thinking with our forebrain, which is the reasoning mind of a human being, and begin thinking with our midbrain, which he says is indistinguishable from the mind of an animal. We literally become scared out of our wits. The only thing that has any hope of influencing our midbrain's response to a situation is conditioning. The kind of conditioning that's used to train firefighters and airline pilots so that they know how to respond in an emergency. It involves repeatedly reenacting an emergency they might face, and then extensive shaping of the desired response to that situation. That way, in a crisis, they'll react properly and save lives at that moment when they are scared out of their wits. As I read this, it was like God was helping me understand why I had always struggled so much to put my faith into practice where my job was concerned. I had put my faith in people and in things. First Valbois, and then my husband. And my conditioned response, when neither could fulfill my need, was despair and wondering, where are you in this, God? This realization began to take hold over days and weeks, and I began to wonder what all those years would have looked like if my conditioned response had been, God, this is not where I want to be. It was not what I signed up for. But I trust you in this. I have faith in your plans for me. You see, I don't believe for a moment that God had a problem with my questioning the direction my life had taken and praying for something different. But I do believe that he ached for me to trust him, to believe in his infinite love for me. The most beautiful example that I see is of Jesus' heart-wrenching prayer on the night before he was crucified. Matthew 26:39 tells us, he, Jesus, fell with his face to the ground and prayed, "My Father, if it is possible, let this cup of suffering be taken from me." Jesus was crying out to God from the place where he didn't want to be, but he didn't stop there. He finished with, "Yet I want your will to be done, not mine." I love the translation from the Message. He fell on his face praying, "My Father, If there is any way, get me out of this. But please, not what I want. You, Father, what do you want? I wish I could tie this up in a beautiful bow for us tonight and tell you that my pressure cooker of emotions is a thing of the past and that I no longer question God's plan for me. But unfortunately, that's not always the case. But on those days, I'm learning to have faith that God is very present and I am exactly where He wants me to be. And to remember Jesus' words, please, not what I want. You, Father, what do you want? This past January, it was 21 years since the first day I walked through the doors at CH2M Hill. He's used every moment of that time to teach me what faith really is. That until I'm willing to accept God's plan for my life as He paints it, and not how I envision it should be, I'll always wonder where He is. And I'll most certainly miss the many blessings He has poured all over my life. I want to close our evening by sharing with you about an almost tangible gift I've been given to help me truly understand faith in action. Most of you are probably aware that I'm a cancer survivor and may have expected me to focus on that journey tonight. When that possibility was mentioned, my first thought was, well, there really isn't a story there. Don't get me wrong. The time I spent battling the disease was the most difficult thing I have ever physically been through. A cancer diagnosis is something none of us expect, and I am no exception. I remember thinking, I've said it can happen to anyone, I just never expected it to be me. As I began chemotherapy, I remember that my biggest concern wasn't what it would be like, the nearly 6 months I would need to receive treatments. My concern was, what kind of survivor will I be? Am I going to wake up each morning and feel my neck for swollen lymph nodes? Will I spend my life worrying about if or when the cancer will come back? As I've shared, trust is not my strong suit. The reason I initially felt that there was little to share is because the answer to both of those questions is no. God hasn't spoken to me in any special way to tell me that I won't have a recurrence. I know, just like every other survivor, that it's a possibility. But what He has given me is a gift of profound faith that I've never experienced before. That even if cancer does rear its ugly head again, He will be there to carry me through. What I have all but heard Him say is, "No worries, Donna, I've got your back." So, I guess I'd say that I was wrong. The exclamation point to our evening is told through my cancer. Because through a dreaded diagnosis, I've been given a twofold gift. Faith that allows me to live without fear, trusting in God for how my cancer journey will ultimately play itself out. And an example of what it would feel like if in every area of my life, I chose to put my faith into action, to trust that when I'm in a place where I don't want to be, or harder still, when someone I love is in that place, I can trust God in the midst of it and with the outcome, whatever it might be. Thank you.